I've been waiting for just before it opened this morning.
We do have a quorum present. Cindy, you want to call you? So I call the meeting of the Ways and Means to order.
And I'll call the Finance Committee to order. And Representative Colbert, why don't you begin by chairing the joint meeting?
And as members come in, the staff first will note their presence. For the members, you don't have a pamphlet this time. You got a green booklet and your name tag. It will be handed out to you. The agenda for today is a presentation of the budget forecast, the gloom and doom forecast, I guess. No, that's not true. But we're pleased to have with us Dr. Stenson, Mr. Showalter, and Commissioner Hansen. We'll let you have an opportunity to have the first part of the show, and do you want to take questions as they come, or do you want to go through your whole presentation?
Mr. Chairman, I think we would like to take them as we go.
Okay, well, Commissioner Hansen, welcome to the committee. Just for everyone's information, and for my as well, we are being recorded on TV. That means you need to turn your cell phone off, otherwise it interferes with the audio. So don't just turn it down, turn it off, if you would, please. I think it's going off, if I can do it. Oh, there it goes. Okay. Commissioner Hansen, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are going to have a three-part presentation. I'll start with the kind of the macro picture and some key points. Dr. Stenson, our state economist, will talk about our economic picture both nationally and in the state of Minnesota and its impact on our anticipated revenues. And Jim Showalter, our state budget director, will talk about the impact the forecast has on our expected expenditures. If you look at the first chart that we have provided, you can see that the combined revenue, expenditure, and reserve changes leaves a projected state deficit of $935 million for the 2008-2009 biennium. This is a $562 million increase, more than what was forecast in November. So some of the key points of this forecast, if you look at your next slide, the story of this forecast continues to be the worsening national economy and its impact on anticipated revenues and expenditures in Minnesota. Our macroeconomic consultant, Global Insights, has forecasted a recession, a mild short recession for the first two quarters of 2008, and a bounce up in GDP in the third and fourth quarter due to the federal stimulus package that Dr. Stenson will talk about in just a minute. The general fund revenues for 2008 and 2009 are now forecast to be $32.5 billion. This is a $530 million decline than what we projected in November, and even more significantly, a $1.27 billion dollar decline since the end of session estimate. You will see in the revenue numbers that our corporate numbers continue to drop, even though we thought we were fairly pessimistic a year ago. In February, they have dropped almost 21% since then. The difference, the other main drop in this forecast is individual income tax. If you remember back to November, we actually had an uptick an individual income tax, Mr. Chairman, but this time that we have a decline. General fund spending for this biennium is forecast to be $34.718 billion. This is up $64 million from November and $130 million since last session's estimate, and on a budget of, on a general fund of $34.7 billion, that's not a whole lot of change. And of the $64.33 of it is the county state management payment to counties that we classified as a reserve after the legislative session that we paid out to counties in December, so it shows up as an expenditure. And then the final point on the slide, before I turn it over to Dr. Stinson, we are expecting a shortfall in 2010-2011 of $1.1 billion. When you factor in the CPI inflation rate, which Global Insights has at 1.9%, you add another $1 billion onto that for a $2.1 billion deficit, potential deficit in 2010-2011. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson.
Dr. Stinson, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Stinson. I'm a state economist. I'm also an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Applied Economics.
Dr. Stinson, I'm going to have you just get a little bit closer to the mic if you can.
Does that work?
That works.
Is that better?
Okay.
As the commissioner noted, the change in the revenue forecast between November and February was $530 million, or about 1.6%. Most of that came from two sources, $313 million decline in individual income tax revenues and $139 million decline, 7.3% decline in corporate income tax revenues. Really, though, these changes need to be put in context of the change from February's forecast and the end of session estimates. And if we look at the next slide here, this shows what happened overall in the forecast. The revenues are down 3.8%. The individual income tax is down $282 million, or 1.8%. The sales tax is down $222 million, or 3.4%. Corporate income tax is down $456 million, or almost 21%. And all other taxes and fees and revenues are down by 3.2%, or $209 million. The total decline since the end of session is $1.27 billion. That's the decline that we've seen since last February's forecast. A substantial amount of that, obviously, is attributable to a significant weakening in the economy. If you look at the change in revenues, total revenues collected in 2006-2007, and the forecast for revenues collection now for 2008-2009, what you see is growth of 0.6% from biennial total revenue. Each of the three major taxes have a slightly different story, and they're all kind of interesting as to how we got to this place. The individual income tax, normally in a recession, what you see is you see a decline in wages due to both more people out of work and people working fewer hours of overtime, fewer hours in the regular jobs. Here we see that in this forecast, but because this forecast is for a relatively short, relatively mild recession, that's not where the change in the revenues comes from largely. The largest portion of the change in revenues comes from non-wage income, particularly from capital gains, interest, and dividend income. And capital gains is the largest piece of that. The capital gains capital gains realizations are expected to drop by about 50% compared to end of session estimates. Now, the growth rate in capital gains realizations is not particularly easy to forecast, even in the best of times. But when there's a recession, we have additional problems, and the problem is that it's almost like an on-off switch. that for sales of businesses and sales of real estate, commercial real estate, they just largely dry up. It's not that they just drop a little bit, but they just largely dry up once there's a recession. And this is a non-trivial portion of the capital gains base. So you have both a decline in realizations in the stock market type of capital gains and a decline in realizations in non-stock market or non-equity related things. In November, we didn't have a recession in the forecast, and so we didn't have that decline going on. Now, given that the stock market outlook is weaker than in November and that we expect the decline, elimination, largely elimination of non-stock market event gains, we brought the forecast down. In November, we had a 10% growth for capital gains in 2008. Now we have 5% decline in 2008, so there's a 15 percentage point spread. Now that may seem like a large amount to you, but in truth, it's not. In 2001, capital gains, as some of you might remember, created a budget problem for the state, except they fell by 45% in the first year of the recession. And in 2002, they fell by 22%. So while there are reasons why we think that this is the right number to have at this point, be aware that things could be much worse in terms of capital gains decline. One of the reasons why we think that this is the right number or the right place to be is that in 2000 and 2001, stock market prices, the equity prices, were a lot more overvalued than they are today. And so there was a bigger gain. We were at a higher peak. We could fall a little bit more. But again, this could be an optimistic estimate of how much of the decline will be. And we could certainly end up with lower capital gains forecast in November or in February of 2009.
Dr. Sims, can I just interrupt you a second on that issue on the capital gains? I know there's a federal kind of a drop-off when the current federal tax program dries up or ends in 2010. And in this forecast, I would assume that you are figuring in additional sales of capital gains in this particular forecast for the next biennium. If the federal government changes that, does that increase our tails obligation in the next? Does it increase the tails in the next biennium? Does it make less money available in the next biennium?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For people who may not be as familiar with all this as the chairman, under the rules of under federal tax rules in 2010, the last year that capital gains would be taxed at a 15% marginal rate. In 2011, the tax goes to 20%. And so what we expect and what's logical to expect people to do is that if you're going to sell stock in January of 2011, you'd look at it and say, wait a minute, I get more for my money, pay less tax by selling it in December. So there will be some acceleration of capital gains into the 2010 tax year, which would show up then in Minnesota in fiscal 2011 as people made their final payments. The other side of it is that that acceleration comes from somewhere, and it comes from 2012 and beyond, and so there would be a drop compared to normal levels in 2012. We don't know how much that would be. We don't have a good forecast for the stock market for 2011, and if we did, we would be richer than we are, I believe. But anyway, What we've done, though, is we've made an estimate, and the estimate is that we've put $327 million of additional capital gains revenue, one-time capital gains revenue, into fiscal year 2011. In November, when we do the forecast, we will take out an approximately the same size amount out of 2012 and 2013. So it adds, under current law, it adds to revenues for 2010, 2011, and it cuts back revenues in 2012, 2013.
Dr. Testa, can you just repeat the number you said?
327.
327, thank you. Representative Voss, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This goes to both Mr. Simpson and Commissioner Hansen. Mr. Simpson, when you did the fiscal report in December, you had used the word recession then. And the governor disagreed and was, I would say, quite pointed with your use of the word recession. Today, both Commissioner Hansen has used the word recession. You've used the word recession. I notice on a number of your slides, I see the word recession. So is it the official position of the Pawlenty administration that we are now in a recession?
And
Mr. and Commissioner Hansen, I've asked you to quote the governor before, and you've been very good at it. So I guess this would be another quote from the governor. So, is it the official position of the Pawlenty administration that Minnesota is now in a recession?
Commissioner Hansen,
Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, I guess I'd answer it a different way. The finance department has macroeconomic consultants. Global Insight has forecasted a recession for the first two quarters, as about half of the national forecasters have. Our forecast does acknowledge that a recession, we believe there will be a recession in the first two quarters of this.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hansen, so it is the official position of the Pawlenty administration that Minnesota is now in a recession.
Our Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, the document, you know, the forecast document you have before you, have that factored in.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm just searching for clarity.
Okay, Dr. Simpson, do you want to continue?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the point that I want to leave you with about the income tax is that the income tax decline, 1.2%, certainly could be larger if we get worse news on the capital gains issue. And the second point about that is that, unfortunately, this is something that we're not going to know anything about until late in 2009 fiscal year. We'll revise our estimates in November and in February, but it's not until the money really starts to flow in April that we know whether we're close on capital gains or whether we're a long ways off on capital gains. And April and May and June don't leave you very much time to fix a potentially large budget hole that could occur because of the capital gains forecast. And so it's something that you want to be thinking about as you're thinking about risk management strategies for dealing with this forecast, that there is significant risk that there could be an April or May surprise in 2009, and that April or May surprise could be either pleasant or unpleasant in there, but there is a significant amount of uncertainty about what's going to happen right at the end of the biennium at this point. For the sales tax, there's a slightly different story, and the slightly different story is that in November we forecast sales taxes were going to be down $309 million. Since then, the economy has worsened, or the economic outlook has worsened, and yet we only added $13 million to the expected decline in sales tax. There are two reasons for that. First of all, the sales tax refund estimate was revised. It was decreased by $35 million, so that added $35 million to the forecast. The second thing is that the federal stimulus package was passed, And the federal stimulus package does stimulate the economy, particularly in consumer non-durable expenditures. I'm sorry, consumer non-auto durable expenditures in the third and fourth quarters. That actually lifts the forecast for spending on big ticket items like televisions, washing machines, refrigerators, and things like that up from what it was in November. And that adds to the forecast and reduces the loss that could come about because of the weaker economy. The weaker economy shows up in lower sales tax receipts on construction materials, shows up in lower sales tax receipts on business fixed investment items, new machinery, and things like that. But on the consumer side, which is the largest portion of our sales tax, that actually helps us. The third piece of revenue bad news is actually the one that is the worst news, and that is on the corporate income tax. We're now forecasting corporate income tax receipts to be $456 million less than was forecast in the end of session estimates. That's almost 21%. It's also about 21% less than we actually received in 2006-2007. Now, if you remember, we told you more than a year ago that we were not as optimistic as Global Insight about what was going to happen to corporate profits, and that we had taken corporate profits down, but obviously we didn't take corporate profits down near enough to have an impact here. There are two pieces to this, one of which you would expect, and that is that as we have a recession, firms make less money, and so they're paying less in estimated tax payments, and that's a portion of it. But the other part that is a little bit surprising is that we suddenly had to pay out a lot more in corporate tax refunds than we would normally have expected. Between the middle of January and the middle of February, we paid out more than $50 million in corporate refunds. That's now not part of the forecast. I mean, that's actual money that's gone. We're not going to get that back. There's zero error on that at this point. So that's something that we're seeing. That's caused us to change our outlook for corporate refunds as well. But at this point, if that were to continue a little bit, that could create some problems even in fiscal 2008.
Just a quick one. Dr. Simpson, is the $50 million included in the 209 then?
Mr. Chairman, no, it's included in the 456.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So that's kind of a quick review of
456.
Yeah, that's right. That's kind of a quick review of the revenue situation. We're now forecasting revenues to be, as I said, $1.27 billion less than we had at the end of session. That's 3.8%. Kind of our standard is that we would like to be within 5%, and so this is still within our standard, but it's a noticeable difference in the revenue. The other thing, as I noted before, is that that's only a 0.6% growth rate over 2006-2007. Now, there are a couple of reasons why that growth rate is so low that don't have to do with the economy. One is that there was the constitutional dedication of a portion of the motor vehicle sales tax. Second, we had one extremely large estate tax payment in 2006-2007, extremely large state tax payment that is not going to occur again. It's almost certain that we will never see an estate tax payment that large again.
Okay. Representative Tulsi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, with regard to the economic stimulus package, could you remind me of what that amount was that's appropriated by the federal government.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tilke, the amount was about 1% of GDP, so it's on the order of $150 billion. Now, the actual number, I think, after the Senate changed the bill, turned out to be like 164, 167, or something like that, but it's roughly $150 billion.
And so, Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, I'm sure you've calculated of that amount, what percentage, what amount would be coming into Minnesota. What is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tilke, again, this is rough, and I'll explain to you in just a minute why it's rough, but if we got our pro rata share, it would be about $2.5 billion. Now, the federal stimulus package has two pieces. One is the rebate to taxpayers, and the second piece is bonus depreciation for firms. And the bonus depreciation part, I'm not sure whether we'll get our pro rata share, or we'll get more, or we'll get less. I suspect that we will get our pro rata share on the largest piece, which is the rebate to taxpayers, and that would be a little bit more than $2 billion.
And Mr. Robertson Hilke, Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson has any calculation they made regarding your expectations of how much of that $2 billion would actually be spent in some way that would stimulate the economy? I mean, particularly in the circumstances that we have currently, one would expect that, first of all, a significant part of that money would go to simply retiring debt. And also, I would think some people would be sufficiently prudent to actually save the money if they had a little windfall. What benefit do we derive from that stimulus, except for collecting sales tax on consumer spending of whatever portion of that there would be?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilton, the assumption that's built into this forecast is that 20% of it is spent in the following quarter. So the checks get sent out in June. Sometime in July, August, or September, 20% of it gets spent. The rest of it gets put either in the bank or to draw down credit card balances. And then in the next quarter, October, November, December, another 20% of it gets spent. Ultimately, about half of it, so another 10%, and then on out, gets spent. The other half is used to draw down balances or to as part of savings. There is econometric evidence and survey evidence that would indicate that maybe a little bit more than that gets spent, but this is a conservative forecast. Still, if you look at what people said they would do and what people actually did looking back at the data, the 20% assumption that it gets 20% of it getting spent does appear to be supportable by the data. Now, with regard to your question of what good does this do except for adding just a little bit of sales tax revenue, it also, frankly, creates jobs and adds to wages, because if you have more money being spent, you have less reason to be cutting hours worked for individuals that are already employed or cutting back on employment. And so this smooths out the employment situation. It adds to number of hours worked. It adds to wages in that way. And, of course, as you've heard multiple times, that money gets re-spent, although the multiplier effect on this would be small. But the initial impact on clerks and stores, things like that, is noticeable.
Okay, I have Representative Rucavina, Lynn Chesky, Raffle. Representative Rucavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, I don't know how to say this the right way, so I think you understand what I'm saying. Does the fact that we have this unusual accounting practice in this state in recent years, where we count inflation on the revenue side but not on the spending side, that does it accelerate or exacerbate the problem when the reality of the forecast actually happens then? Or isn't that a factor? Do you understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, I don't think that it makes much difference, and here's my reason why. There's so much visibility given to the finance department's inflation estimates because we write it on a separate line that I think that you all know, and the public actually knows, both sides of the story, and you know what's going on here. And so, you know, I guess, well, it would be nice to have a situation where there was one clean number and you didn't have to write it out in two lines. I don't think that it prevents people from getting the information, and it may even highlight the information because people raise the question as to, you know, the real number is this or that. So in answer to your question, I don't think it creates any undue problem at this point.
Well,
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering because, you know, you've anticipated a certain amount of revenue and growth in the economy and counted that into the November forecast or whatever. Then it didn't happen. But the inflation happened, whether it was in, you know, road materials or nursing home expenses. And I just wondered if it created a bigger problem due to the fact that now we see more of the what we had on the bottom line, it got eaten up, I assume, because of the inflation, but maybe I'm totally off base in that, and so I just wondered if it had even more of an accelerated effect.
Dr. Stinson, would you try to have a short answer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, I don't think the inflation estimate changed very much. If I remember, 0.1% for 1 year or something like that. Frankly, the problem is not the inflation estimate for 2010-2011. The problem is the slow growth in revenues, and the fact that something that bothers me personally, I guess, is that there is this one-time piece of revenue from the capital gains that the chairman talked about earlier that's counted in there that then not only goes away but leaves a hole of roughly equal size in 2012-2013, and those are the things that are more of a concern to me.
Representative Lenczewski.
Thank you. I had a different question, but just you mentioning the one-time capital gains realization shift that's going to take place. Members may recall the vetoed tax bill had a tax volatility account to address that issue. We're going to try that again. And that would force us to all recognize that in our budgeting and prepare for that change, although who knows what Congress will do. But I have a question on monetary policy, and I have not read all the back sheets of this yet, but Dr. Stinson, are you projecting in Bernanke doing another inflation cut? I mean, he's kind of assuming that that's going to take place, and then additionally, you know, what's your guess on, and does the forecast assume that Congress will pass another stimulus package if things continue to sour? So how is the congressional monetary policy being factored into this forecast?
Dr. Stinson.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn Stinson. In answer to your second question first, are we assuming that there will be another stimulus package? No, we're not assuming there will be another stimulus package. This is a one-time event, and it leaves, as I'll talk about in a little bit, a real question about what happens in the first part of 2009. Okay, with respect to monetary policy, this forecast assumes that the Federal Reserve keeps pushing interest rates down. They go down to 2% and stay at 2% through, I can look it up, but really through the end of the year and a little bit into 2009. Then it'll begin to go back up. The problem with that is that, as you well know from your macroeconomics class at the Humphrey Institute.
And he was my professor, by the way, can I just say.
That the Fed has more than one goal here. They really have three goals. One is to make sure that the banking system has enough liquidity to work. The second is to stimulate the economy. You can get both of those by lowering interest rates and pumping money into the system. And the third is to make sure that inflation doesn't take off. And the way that you get that is by raising interest rates and taking liquidity out of the system. And as long as inflation remains under control, then you're in good shape. You only have to push the lever one way. But if inflation begins to get out of control and the Fed begins to see the inflation numbers get out of control, then you have to make a decision as to which way you push the lever. And the problem is more complicated because it takes a while for monetary policy to work. 12, 18 months for pushing the lever toward more growth to work. Maybe 6 months for it if you push the lever toward less growth to work. And so we could be in a situation where if you look at this...
Now let's go on to the next one. I think that's a very interesting
forecast here, that this growth right here, which is 6-tenths or 7-tenths of a percent, is after the stimulus package has run out. It's before the Fed easing really has had enough time to come on. If they've already had to put the brakes on, this could then drop below and we could be in a recession again. So that's the concern. And I'll go on just a little bit further here, and that is that one of the concerns that we have in the finance department is the oil forecast for the Global Insights using to produce this scenario. And the oil forecast that they're using assumes that oil prices get to $75 a barrel in the next quarter, stay at $75 a barrel. That looks like it's a stretch. Now, it's not an impossibility. If the economy weakens, you could have lower oil prices. The problem, if you don't have oil prices, isn't catastrophic, but it knocks 2-tenths or 3-tenths of a percent off the growth rate for each $10 per barrel that oil prices are above the target that you have. So oil prices by themselves at $100 a barrel might take 6-tenths, 7-tenths, 8-tenths off of this, but this is 3.4. It doesn't make any difference. Same here. This is 2.7, brings it down to 2.0, doesn't make any difference. 0.7 brings it down to 0, brings it down to a little bit less. And so again, this is a concern that you have looking out about the risk in the forecast. And this is, you know, a major piece of the risk. In the last few days, the inflation news has not been particularly good. We've seen both higher commodity prices, and it appears that higher commodity prices are beginning to be worked into the cost of goods, the producer price index at this point. You know, the Fed is going to have to make a decision. When do they change from pushing on the economy to shutting the economy down a little bit? That's going to be a real tricky decision for Chairman Bernanke to make.
Yeah, I've got several on the list. I wonder if we can kind of keep our questions and answers short to the point. Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Stinson, on page 3 of the finance report you sent out, I'm going to make a statement. I'm not going to ask a question about that, but I'll follow it up with a related question. It says the economy buoyed by the stimulus package then bounces back strongly. And I'm assuming that there is
no dispute that lowering costs for taxpayers, that having them keep more of what they have, has a positive effect on economic growth. My question is it the other way? If we are negating the effects of that, if we are increasing costs, whether it's in the terms of things we don't control, like higher energy prices, or if we are increasing taxation, does it work the other way? In other words, if we increase the cost, do we in fact negate the positive impact of the stimulus package?
And Dr. Stentz, can I add one other thing, that other factor on that, and that is cutting state spending as well.
Now I've forgotten the first question. Let me talk a little bit to your question about a tax increase and an associated spending increase. If you increase taxes and increase spending, that actually increases GDP. Because that money that is collected actually gets spent. There's a theorem called the balanced budget multiplier that says that a 1% increase in taxes and a 1% increase in spending gives you a 1% increase in GDP. So, that's a mathematically provable thing that I can show you at some point or something like that. So that by itself is not a problem. I can't quite remember your first part of your question, but your first part of your question, I think, had to do something with the difference between real and nominal spending. Oh, yeah, you were saying inflation. Well, go ahead, tell me what your first part of your question
was. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, there's more of a statement is that if we reduce costs, if we reduce taxes and people keep more of what they earn, I don't think there's a dispute, because it says it in the report, that we're going to expand the economy greater so than if we didn't do that. I don't think there's any dispute in that, because, again, it's in the report. My question is that if we're raising taxes and we are reducing the amount of the taxation reduction from the federal government, does that have a negative effect on the economic growth that we are forecasting? In other words, and we're using ballpark figures here, the Minnesota portion of the federal stimulus package is $2.5 billion. If we raise taxes at the local level, $700-900 million, and we knock the net effect of the rebates down to 1.5 or 1.6, do we see a corresponding reduction in the amount of forecasted economic growth?
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo. One, I don't think it's appropriate to, that's not the way to put it. I don't think that it's being modeled as a tax reduction. The rebate package is not being, or stimulus package is not being modeled as a tax reduction. It's being modeled as money falling from heaven. you just have this windfall. The money falls in your front yard, and you can do with it whatever you want. And it's not something that you would expect to have long. You don't expect that this money is going to fall in your yard the next day as well, or anything like that. It's one-time money, and so that's how it's being modeled. So it's not an offsetting tax increase. Now, if you have a tax increase at the state level and don't spend the money, that will reduce the amount of benefit that you get out of that money falling from the sky. Okay, if you have a tax increase at the state level and you spend the money, then you will have you'll actually have a small increase in that.
And Dr. Stinson, a third one of that, if you have just a state spending decrease, what does that do? That's the third option. No tax increase, just a decrease in state spending.
In the short term, just a decrease in state spending with no change in taxes would decrease the amount, the effect on the amount of economic output in the state.
Okay. Dr. Stinson, we got a couple of other people. Can you just go through a couple of graphs and I kind of keep it moving a little bit?
Sure.
And then we'll get through some additional information for a few more graphs. And I know the last one is, Dr. Stinson, maybe if you get to that graph right there, I think is an important one.
Mr. Chairman, my question follows.
Okay, let me call on you, then Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In light of what you just said about a tax increase and spend the tax increase, it seems to me the transportation bill impact on our economy is a positive one.
Dr. Stinson, you can always take the Fifth Amendment.
It follows, Mr. Chairman, exactly what you're saying. We're going to have a net increase in our, Minnesota's net domestic product.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, the important thing about the transportation bill isn't the short-term economic effects one way or the other. The important thing about the transportation bill is whether or not it increases productivity in Minnesota and the long-term return there. And that's what we're really looking at with a transportation investment like that. And the question then is the return on building more roads, more bridges, or repairing roads and bridges higher than the return that we would get just from that money that was being spent to build new plant and equipment somewhere else. And so that's the issue, and that's something that we'll see.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes, Mr. Faffel?
And that's just my point, is the initial question I was getting to, is that in the economic report here, you know, this money from the federal government is a temporary reduction in the marginal tax rate that people are paying for calendar year 08. It would seem by our own economic report we are saying that money staying in Minnesota as opposed to going to Washington, D.C., by definition, yields more productivity. That's why we see an expansion in third quarter economic growth. And so I'm confused as to why, if that's the case, why a increase in taxes or a reduction in the amount of the rebate would not have a converse.
Well, let me try to answer that a little bit. I think that what Dr. Stinson is saying is not smarter than I am. But he answered Representative Earhart's question by saying it's a long-term productivity. And I think your question is that be less spending, which is a short-term thing as opposed to a long-term economic stimulus of being more productive. And one thing I have learned from Dr. Stinson is that to increase my actual wages is not to get a wage increase, but to become more productive. When I become more productive, that's when I actually raise my standard of living. And I think that's what Dr. Stinson is. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I guess I did. And you can refute those.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like maybe Representative Linchensky is not the only one that's listened to my lectures.
I didn't listen to your lectures, but I did have an economic professor that ended up to be the commissioner or the secretary of labor under Bill Clinton. So I think Representative Kahn and I had that same kind of lecture from him as well. So, okay, Dr. Stinson, can we just kind of continue on quickly then?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, real quickly, this shows what happened to expected real GDP growth from the February forecast to the November forecast to the current forecast. In 2008, 1.4% growth now. In 2009, 2.2% growth. This next chart is a chart that you've seen in various guises before. It shows what happens to the level of GDP compared to 2007, February 2007 and November. The dashed line, the heavy dashed line, is what the forecast for real GDP growth was in February 2007. The area between that line and the lighter dashed line is the revenue loss, the loss in economic output between the February 2007 and November 2007. the area between the heavy dashed line and the solid line is the loss in revenue and real GDP growth between February 2007 and February 2008. Two points you can see. One is the stimulus package, again, does make a difference. You can see how this bounces up a little bit there in the last part of 2008. The second thing is you can see that this is an ongoing problem, that the gap doesn't really narrow, that growth rates aren't ever faster, enough faster than the growth rates assumed in February of 2007, that the lines converge in a meaningful manner and touch. So this means that the problem extends on out 2010, 2011, 2012, really forever. Next picture we've talked about a lot, but this is just the picture that shows you what happens to non-auto durable, non-auto consumer durables in this forecast compared to November, and you can see that there is that little bit as spending actually increases based on the stimulus package. Two things that I want to get through real quickly here. The first is the outlook for the housing industry. If you look at the housing industry, this has just been disastrous for Minnesota. We have gone from, on a seasonally adjusted basis, 2,400 housing permits per month in December, in the fourth quarter of 2005, to 1,200 housing permits per month in the fourth quarter of 2006, to 800 housing permits per month in the fourth quarter of 2007. The last bit, the fourth quarter of 2007, was even weaker than we had forecast in our November forecast. This first dashed line here in the center, that is what the November forecast was. This white bar is where we actually were. That forced us to revise our forecast down noticeably for the rest of the year and really beyond. The situation with respect to housing is serious in Minnesota. The construction industry, we now estimate, will lose 13,000 jobs in 2008, lost 8,000 jobs in 2007. The lumber and wood products industry, we estimate, will lose an additional 2,200 jobs in 2008. It lost nearly 2,500 jobs in 2007. These are really significant losses in a key sector of Minnesota's economy. If you are concerned about this, the question is, how do we get out of this? And the answer is that we get out of it by working through inventory. Inventories are too high at this point. The existing home sales aren't sufficient to eat into the inventories. Mark Zandi of economy.com estimates that if you have housing growth nationally of 900,000 units, which sounds like a lot of housing construction in 2008, but actually would be the weakest year since World War II. And if you have no employment growth, which is consistent with the forecast that we have and consistent with the forecast that he has, that it would take a 20% decline in housing prices for us to get back to a more normal inventory by the end of 2008. That's just almost certainly not going to happen. So that means that the construction and the housing problems extend into 2009, absent that kind of an activity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the indulgence. I have to leave here in a moment. But one question I want to get in, Dr. Stinson, before I have to leave is the, and this hooks in with jobs a little bit, but the bonding bill, as long as we have our capital investment chair here. what jeopardizes our bond rating more, if the bill is bigger than $825 million or if the reserves are sapped too much, or are they linked with each other?
Mr. Chairman, looking at Cypher, the 3% guideline has been something that Minnesota has been known for. It's a symbol of our financial integrity, our financial responsibility. Rating agencies, I believe, would take a violation of the 3% guideline as more of an affront than are using the reserve. We've used the reserve, and we've proven to rating agencies that if we use the reserve, responsible amount of it, that we can rebuild the reserve later on, and that we have the determination to do that. But violating the 3% guideline would not be a good idea from the rating agency point of view, I don't believe.
And Dr.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, you're saying 3% of the general fund, not redefining it, 3% of whatever people are trying to justify a $965 million bill with, personal income or GDP, this or that. You're saying the traditional guideline that this legislature has used for over 25 years is the one that the rating agencies are looking at, not some type of redefinition.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parker, yes, I believe that changing the definition would cast a question about fiscal responsibility and fiscal management practices in the state.
To this point, if we can, I'm passing out an issue, and there's another one that I want to pass out as well. And Dr. Stinson, Maui, this is not for you so much as it is for Commissioner Hansen. You can. We get a copy of the fact that Commissioner Hansen, this is your report to us on our net capacity. And I know you signed the letter, or I think you initialed it anyway. Yes, they probably didn't necessarily create it, but I'll wait till you get that, if you can. But the first one I passed out to you, I want to call your attention to the second page of that particular, the debt managing policy of the Department of Finance. And then on the other letter that is coming to you that you sent to the legislators on the 28th. There's two questions I think we need to explore today. If I can divert a little bit from the presentation. The first question is, if you look at the chart on the bigger one that I have in front of you, general obligation appropriation for debt service not to exceed 3%, even though we've had that as a guideline all the years, and we passed what we thought was a 3% guideline. As we look at the past history from 1994 on up, we're not close to the 3%. And then I want to refer your letter, Commissioner Hansen, to the second part of your letter. And they asked the question, well, why the disconnect between what we think is the 3% and what actually is the bonding? And I suppose there are some management things that are in there as well. But it's kind of, I want to call your attention to the first letter sentence in the second page of that, the future debt capacity. And it says future general obligation debt capacity is forecast through 16 and 17. So as we try to come up with that magic number of the 3%, there seems to be a disconnect happening between what's happening in the legislature and what is happening in reality. Can and in looking with some staff, it seems like Well, probably that disconnect is because when we're projecting what the economy is going to be the present time in 16 and 17, and we've never gone out that far. I mean, like, tell me what the economy is going to be like in 16 and 17. So I need to have a little bit of more explanation of how the figure 965 or how the figure 825 or whatever it is determined, other than just the sloppy calculation, because there sure seems to be a disconnect between what we think is reality and what is reality. Commissioner Hansen, can you help us with that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take a stab at it. The calculation for the 3% debt limit has gone on through multiple commissioners, multiple governors, and the calculation is simply, and it's defined in statute, that we look out over a period beyond our planning horizon. So right now our planning horizon is both to 10 and 11, and then we take 6 years beyond that. And we have to estimate non-dedicated general fund revenues. So we take our latest Global Insight report and some of the factors in there, and it's difficult enough for us to determine what our income is going to be in fiscal 2010 and 11, but we have to extrapolate. What we do is we extrapolate out to 2017, and we just assume that we know what the income, the non-dedicated general fund revenues are going to be in 2017. Then, you know, that's the denominator, and then in the formula, the numerator is the what we think our debt service is going to be. We factor in the bonding that we have authorized, that the legislature has authorized and it's been issued. We factor in the bonds that have been authorized but unissued, and this is GO bonds. And then we factor in, based on what we think, or what we think the size of the bonding bill will be out through 2017. And we take the, you know, just like we do in the forecast, we take the 10-year average. So that's all to say that there's a lot of calculations that go into the management of the 3% debt. And over the years, and obviously the, you know, your chart goes back to 94, 95, which goes back a few commissioners and a few governors, but it has consistently, with the Department of Finance, been a fairly conservative estimate. And it is, I mean, if you look at the any publication, and the bond buyer just had a article which we were mentioned as adhering to our 3% limit. So any, even a recalculation of it should not be taken lightly on our part. At a time when, you know, it looks worse when we're in deficit, the economy is where it is, and we're in a year where we are doing a bonding bill. If it looks like we're doing it for the purpose of creating more room for immediacy, it looks even worse. That is a, Jim, I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, if you can identify yourself for this.
Certainly. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. And I put, unfortunately, a piece of paper on the overhead, which appears to be a little bit too small a type to look at very well, but it shows there are four debt management guidelines. There are four of those, and that includes the 3% general fund debt service ratio, the 2.5% debt to personal income ratio, and based upon the maximum capacity, what you see is here that over the period of time, as the commissioner suggested, what we try to do is estimate how much can you authorize a new debt, then project how that debt will be released, what kind of interest rates would be needed to support the bonds that would be going out to pay for those projects, and then ultimately that folds back into the debt service estimate. As you see here, by 2012 and 13, that ratio goes to 2.99. Not sure about what the next digit is. It drops a little bit by 2014 and 15, and then returns back to 2016 and 17. The nature of those numbers really is a fairly complex set of variables going into it, but if you could boil it down, it's, we have a couple of large bonding bills. If we kept on going at this level, we would essentially go to that 3% level because of the release of those authorizations and a release of those bonds over a period of time.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah. We had some good testimony yesterday in the Capital Investment Committee, and part of what was emphasized is the very points on page 2 of the memo from the department where we have the 5 criteria, and you referenced some of them with that last overhead. The focus often seems to be on the 3%, but yet there are other guidelines that are a part of the policy, and so my question is, because those numbers can vary, why the 3% being more important than the other guidelines that are listed there, at least those that dictate what the size of the bill might be.
Mr. Chair, I think all of those guidelines are important. As Dr. Stinson said, in the presentations and in the discussions with the rating agencies, typically through the past number of years, at least in my involvement, and I'll let Dr. Stinson speak for his more extensive discussions with the rating agencies, the 3% guideline has been one of those key factors because the GO, general funded debt, has usually been the one that is the most visible. The broader 2.5% versus personal income standard is also an important measure, but we have been fairly far away from that, although with the transportation bonding that was just recently enacted, we will start to get much closer to that level as well.
Well, to a point of correction on that, my understanding from the testimony is that your third guideline there is the total amount of indebtedness, and since it's bonding of the transportation is not general obligation bonds, but transportation trucks, the guideline that you have there is the 5% for total obligation of general obligation transportation leases and so forth. So is that correct?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that it's not, that the general obligation debt shall not exceed 2.5% of state personal income is general obligation debt regardless of funding source. Trunk highway bonds are general obligation debt, but they're supported by the trunk highway fund, which is a separate fund from the general fund. The first guideline is the general fund appropriation shall not, for debt service, shall not exceed 3%. That is the general fund specific measure. The broader one for all general obligation debt, which is backed basically by the full faith and credit of the state, is that 2.5%.
Okay, I interrupted. But
that's fine, Mr. Chairman. What leaves me kind of wondering, we've got the guidelines there that the department has, and Mr. Showalter, your comment a moment ago was that the 3% is one of the key factors. And I think that reinforces the very point that I was trying to make, is that there are at least three of the 5 guidelines that would determine the size could be looked at, either individually or in combination, and I think the question that we're raising is why the heavy emphasis on the 3 as opposed to the other, when some of us have been around long enough where we've heard the story. I wasn't at the meeting, but a former governor supposedly was meeting with the bond houses or one of them in New York, and the 3% was just a very informal comment that became a guideline at a certain point of time and has since been followed, but it wasn't anything that had been the result, as I understood it, of any research or anything. It was just sort of what would be a good guideline, and somebody at the meeting threw out 3%. They always assumed they could have thrown out 2.5 or 3.5. I think the point was that you had some sort of a benchmark. The other question, though, that I have for one of you, we had an option. We could have come into session earlier this year in January, and we could have built a bonding bill based on the November forecast, which would have been, depending on definition, 905 or 965. And had we passed that at some point in January, prior to yesterday at any rate, we would have been within the 3% guideline. So here we are today, because there's a drop in revenue. As the minority leader asked the question, I put on the table, and there's been some discussion since yesterday, apparently from the standpoint of the governor, of 825. Should we have, if we would have passed the bill in January, adjusted the bonding bill as a result of a February forecast, or would we have been meeting the guidelines and able to move ahead? I guess that would be maybe more to the commissioner or Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Hanson.
The 3% guideline is, I mean, to your comment a minute ago, it is the, there are multiple criteria that the ratings agencies look at. And we actually had a presentation prepared for the LCPP the other day that got cut off the agenda. I hope either that or maybe this group is a fairly educational. It's the one factor in today or in, under the current circumstances that we probably have the most control over. We don't have control over the national economy and what it does to us. You know, as Dr. Stinson has explained, you know, short-term our stimulus, difficult to impact our economy at a state level. Our financial management, we've done a pretty good job, but at times our political philosophies collide, and it makes it difficult for us to come to agreements in a timely manner. Then you get to the debt limit. That's been the most consistent, and while it started may have started as an offhanded comment, it has been the most consistent financial management tool we have had, and it may have started out soft, but over time it has solidified. I don't know what if we had if we had exceeded the if we had passed the $965 million bonding bill, and then our revenues went down, I am sure that the ratings agencies would look at that, and wasn't a something we did willingly or knowingly that in our next spot, that we would self-correct in the future, is what my assumption would be.
Mr. Chairman, just a...
Yeah, sure. But please, awful.
First of all, I really appreciate the fact that Minority Leader Seifert threw this out there and then left the room.
And then runs, huh?
Yeah. I guess I just have a question, and I can ask Chairman Hausman when she gets back, sure. But I'll ask as a lead finance committee. It's only my fourth year here. I didn't think there was any debate over this, and what I'm hearing is there's some discussion. Can you tell me, is this actually, is breaking this rule being considered right now or not?
I don't know if it's being considered or not. The Senate has passed something different. But my question is an extremely serious question. If we're going to have a 3% guideline, and we have followed that since I've been in the legislature except for one particular time, what is the disconnect between the actual 3% and the chart that is on this one that shows that we're not at that 3%? And then the question relates, I think, somewhat, is how do you estimate, we're having a hard time estimating 10 and 11, how do you estimate going about to 16 and 17 to determine that debt capacity?
Mr. Chairman, my chart shows us we are within 3. I guess I'm, am I missing?
No, yes, you are within the 3%, but you're below 3% each year, even though we had, when we passed the bill each time, that we said we were at the 3%.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to speak for the Department of Finance, but I would assume that's because when we pass our bonding bill, we don't issue the bonds instantaneously.
But if you have an issuation of... And that may be a part of it, but it's also, I think, based on the second letter, that the 3% is an estimate of income out for 8 years. So we just need to have some clarification of this, because we've had a conversation with the bond house that says, well, 3% might be a guideline, but the other guidelines are, I think, more important.
Chairman, in 05 and 06, we passed billion-dollar bonding bills. And as of a month ago, when I read the Department of Finance's website, I want to say about $500 million of those bonds had not been let yet. Now, they can correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it was. And the reason why is when we pass our bonding bill, we don't immediately issue these bonds because
they may not need them yet. And we don't prescribe in the legislation, which on most bonding authorizations, a requirement that the bonds be issued at a certain time. I think,
but we have to have the appropriations for the bonds in the forecast.
As we
should. So this is the this reflects that appropriation, I think. So, well, let's have some clarification of that.
Sure.
I cut Representative Carlson off, too.
Well, I can stop for others, but the point I was trying to make with my last question there was, in part, the question is when you take the picture. And the minority leader put a number on the table that was 100, maybe 150 million below what we were talking about under some of the governor's recommendations just a few days ago. And the only thing that has changed is that now we have a new forecast. And my point was, had we acted on the bill in January, had we come in earlier and acted on a bonding bill, we would have been in within the 3%. Now, all of a sudden, a month later, the minority leader is using a different calculation, apparently, to arrive at 825, which I assume is the 3% on the new number. But what was really driving my question as a result of the minority leader putting the question on the table is that we do have, in the guidelines that were distributed here by Representative Solberg, different measurements that are either a part of the equation or could be used. And we emphasize one of the three more than the other two. And that was the gist of my question, why that one more than the other two. And
quite frankly, I think just to tag on a little bit, in some discussions we've had with groups like NCFL and so forth, that we've asked, does any other state have a 3% guideline? And it's very difficult because most states don't have that as part of, they do have, a lot, most of them have, and they're all over the board. Some of them have no debt at all. But some of them, most of them are, the percent of personal income was a better guideline.
And Mr. Chairman, I want to be respectful. I just want to correct something that Chairman Carlson said, again, respectfully. The reduction in the amount of GO availability is not exclusively because of the economic forecast. On Monday, the legislature authorized additional GO bonding that was part of the bill.
The budget went down from 965 to 885 as a result of the forecast.
Yes, but Mr. Chairman, the transportation bill authorized additional GO bonding. That's also part of the reason why the number is lower.
No, not from 865 to 885.
But again, Chairman Carlson said that that's the only factor of why we went from 965 to whatever the number represented Cypher Cypher. Part of that number is the economic forecast. Part of it is GL bonding we've authorized. I mean, my point here, and I'll let it go after this, is that it sounds like this is being considered, that we're gonna pick a couple of these rules and obey them. And I don't have the authorization to speak for my caucus. That's not my role. I personally, I have a real problem with that. So that's not a caucus position. That's me, though.
Well, I'm trying my best to get some information on what the disconnect is between the 3% and that reality.
Chairman,
Representative, or Commissioner Hansen and Representative Kahn. I want to go to Representative Haldeman first, then, too. But can I have Commissioner Hansen?
Well, just here, your disconnect. We're plugging a lot of assumptions in, as you said, going out that far. But one of the reasons why we leave room under the 3% is for the fluctuations in those assumptions. So we don't end up with Representative Carlson's situation where all of a sudden we're above our 3% limit. And then we're not properly managing, and it's not much of a guideline. So the guideline is looking ahead and allowing yourself some space to grow within the 3%.
Okay. Representative, can I go to Representative Hausman and then Representative Hausman?
Mr. Chair, I was somewhat surprised that Mr. Simpson made that one very clear declared statement about one guideline, and I didn't know if he knew there were five guidelines that the state has for debt management. But, members, I want to read from Moody, because I think this discussion, you know, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous trap. And there's a little bit of knowledge here. But this is Moody. And in their discussion about the state of Minnesota, they give the positives that we do have a low debt ratio, that we do have strong industrial diversity, healthy demographics. Then they say these strengths are offset by the challenge of potential political gridlock preventing the legislature from reaching consensus for its budget. I read that to you to say, I think we have to be rather careful in so carefully defining one thing as though that is sort of the definitive answer for the economic health of our state. So that's my only caution in this. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and I think knowing that they also watch our decision-making process, are we able to govern, are we able to manage in a responsible way? The rating agencies actually care about that.
Mr. Thorolder, did you want to comment? Then I've got Khan and McNamara.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I think just a couple of points. One is that in the rating, they do look at a number of factors. Certainly financial management has been one of our strong points. Looking backwards, that has been one of the areas where Minnesota has been rated individually stronger than most other states. Also, in terms of the expectations for Minnesota, as a AAA state or trying to retain it, get back to a place where all three rating agencies, regardless of the AAA state, we would have stronger, more careful management of our financial obligations than most other states, because there's only a couple AAA states out there right now. And just the last consideration is, in terms of why the debt capacity may change over time, I think the rating agencies will understand that interest rates, the timing of obligations, things like that will have that figure fluctuate over time. I think the key thing to Representative Carlson's point was, how are we acting so that we specifically manage our house with the information that we have? And we've been trying to make sure that everyone has the best information that we can provide. And with that information, then, you know, it's a question of how we do that, what decisions we decide to make.
Representative Khan.
Yes. Before I was a legislator, I worked a lot with data and a lot with numbers. And one of the things that if I were facing something that looked like this, where we're trying to hit three at all times, and we are consistently below it, I would say, obviously, that the way that you get to that is that you must need to go above. And you certainly, maybe, you could do it by the average, or you could do it by the highest, you know, at least the 0.3. The 0.3%. Then the other thing, it seems to me that the governor, which was what was so surprising to me about his veto of the bonding bill last year, and, you know, when we're talking about economic stimulus, I think it would have been awfully nice to have some construction and some repair and so forth going on now instead of waiting for it for a year from now. But the total control that the governor has, and I think the total way to control this number with a very fine-tooth comb is not in what the appropriation is, but in how the bonds are let. And I do know, for example, when I was first here, we actually did most authorizing of projects in three steps. We did planning funds first, and then we did architectural drawings first, and then we did the final construction. And we did that over 3 year or even more sessions. But it seems to me that in letting, and there is a certain amount of definitiveness in saying we're going to do the whole project and this is what it's going to cost, and so not going back to the legislature three times. But it seems to me that flexibility in letting the bonds could very easily be in place. And I'm sure that you have it in place, and that it's still a very positive thing for people to know they're going to do something, even if the bonds aren't let as fast as they can, particularly in some of the ones where we've got lots of mixed funding. We've got a private funding compared with the state, combined with the state funding, or a state or university bonding combined with state bonding. And I would assume that, just again looking at what we've done, if we made our calculation to go over 3%, two things. One, it would look, say, 3.3% to be safe instead of taking the average of all of these. The first thing is, it looks as if we probably hit 3 then, just from past practice. But the point is, there's no chance that we wouldn't, because you would have all of that ability to deal with what time the when the bonds are let. And it doesn't, the appropriation, you know, could be smaller. Seems to me we could make the appropriation smaller than what the debt service is, with the assumption that we'll let the bonds on a lower.
I don't know if that's a statement or a question.
It's a kind of a question. Why can't we do it the way I just told you to do it?
Just a
question.
Couple of things, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, your point. Well, first, I can't imagine a time when you weren't in the legislature. You've been here as long as I have, no longer. But the we have $700 million of authorized but unissued bonds.
Yes.
So they're bonds that, you know, authority that's there that is unused. So that's such a good point, that we have projects that aren't ready to go and capacity that is tied up with that. As far as, I'm not understanding, because it's, you know, if you're, I don't understand your calculation on where.
Well, my calculation, Mr. Chairman, my calculation is whatever's kept us below that 3, we should go above it to get down to the 3 instead of stay below it. And I'm saying that there's no danger. I'm worrying Garofalo seems so panicked that we'll throw the state into nuclear catastrophe if we do that. But I'm saying that there truly is no danger, because the executive branch has complete charge of when the bonds are issued. So I'm saying, and you know, we can. I'm not sure what our general fund appropriation for the debt service is based on.
What you're saying is, we could go, in order to hit a 3% average, we could
go to
authorize more,
yes.
Like, you know, have a 3.3%. And then control when we issue the bonds,
yes.
Which will really, the debt is actually below.
Well, I don't want to get bogged down on this, and we've got a couple.
That's just out as a proposal. You don't have to.
Mr. Chair.
Say yes right away.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple of things I'm not sure we're all clear about,
yes.
And that is, if the legislature in 1 year authorizes a bonding bill that is at that debt limit, that is not to suggest that instantly
no. The
state debt limit will snap to 3%.
Right.
That is basically saying, if the legislature continues at that level, that is basically our new target.
Right.
And so that's part of why even the chart that was handed out and is on our website shows that the line is starting to go up. So by starting to continue to authorize at our debt limit, you know, we are starting to see it get to that 3% limit. We're making some copies of the, basically some backup from the letter from Commissioner Hansen, that talks about the debt service with this forecast, and that shows you how that it's not just this legislature, it's future legislatures. As you continue to authorize debt at that level, you will get to that 3% limit. So it's less an estimating issue as much as a responsiveness issue. We talked about interest rates in the economy before, how it's not automatic. You lower interest rates, that the economy will instantly zoom. It's somewhat similar. There's a lag, and there's a number of other factors that are involved.
So just one quick question and a comment. This is assuming 885 in the even and or in the even, 120 in the odd. Going out from Europe biennium upon biennium. We didn't do the 120 last year, obviously. But so I don't know if that shifts a little bit. I think to it, it's a different management style, I guess, this happens. But just let me ask you a question. If you did a big one this year, more than 885, that's your management, and you did less in the future years. And the reason I want to pursue this question a little bit is, as Dr. Stenson has indicated, our job situation is horrible, and it doesn't look very good in the future. And we need to have some stimulus the Republican candidate for the president said, instead of giving a stimulus package of a check back, why don't we build a highway between Boston and Atlanta, Georgia, put people to work instead. So I just, you know, I guess if you did run bigger than smaller, would that, with that part of your management guidelines?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let me, I want to sort of represent McNamara too, but.
What? I wasn't finished with them.
Oh, well, you are now. They got to go. Now, you can answer that later on. I do want to skip over Representative McNamara. And so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to stay away from Representative Kahn for sure, because as she talked about her seniority in the legislature, she was my state representative when I was in college. And as we all know, I've spent 30 years in the landscape business since I was in college, so I was going to stay away, but Commissioner Hansen made, and that's why I didn't want it. If you wanted to keep talking, I was going to be more than willing. What I want, I have a question, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Dr. Stinson, I've never played the role, or maybe it's also for Commissioner Hansen, the role of negotiating with the bond houses, and I think it's interesting. We all want to talk to you about how we feel you could present the negotiations with the bond house in how we're being good about the management of our money. And I just am thinking, as I was doing that, I was thinking about going into the bank or as a small business owner, and I never felt that I was the one telling them what rate they should pay me. I was going there to tell them how great of a job I was doing, and then they told me the rate I was going to get, and if I didn't like it, I wasn't going to be in the landscape business next year. And so I think it's interesting that we're having all the discussion about how we think we can frame it so we can borrow more money, which I did as a small business person too. But if I properly managed my cash, I got a better rate from them. My question centers around the fact, if all the bond houses knock us down a notch, what's the effect to the state of Minnesota and our pocketbook?
Somebody want to take that, Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are several different impacts. The most obvious is that we would pay a slightly higher cost for the bonds that we issue. Our debt costs would be somewhat higher. Certainly there's a general management and sort of prestige issue that's associated with it, with Minnesota trying to be an example and do its work as well as possible. I think the other real clear impact would be that other issuers that essentially borrow based upon our good credit would also be impacted. That would be include the local units of government and school districts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Showalter, but I'm curious to know, so does that mean 20 basis points, and or if it did mean, or 25 basis points, what does that equate on a biannual budget? What is the effect?
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that. Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell or former Assistant Commissioner Peter Selson probably be better suited to answer that question. I don't think the number of basis points would be huge. What I think is also difficult to estimate is that each daily market is different, and so it's hard to, I think, see through to what the rating is different versus who happens to be in the market or what economic news may be happening that day. So I know there's a difference, but I don't know what the...
Well, just to answer your question a little bit, because we've had some experience with Dr. Selson, or Mr. Selson, and it's kind of almost the day that they issue the bonds kind of determines the basis points of what's on the market in that particular day and everything else. And it may have something to do with AAA ratings, or if it's AA plus or whatever it happens to be, may have an effect. But I think if we would go back in history, we would see probably some effect of that on when Representative or Commissioner or Governor Carlson came into office, and there was a change in our ratings, and it may or may not be very much. I think it has some impact, but I think more of an impact is the day of the sale and what's going on in the market that particular day. Representative Westrom. And I know Dr. Stenson and have to leave at 1:30.
So. Mr. Chair, I'll be brief, but just in response to Representative Kahn, I think we need to frame the context. Your hypothesis was that we want to hit 3%. I think, at least how I've always understood that number, is that wants that number should be our ceiling, not what we could get a hit. Similar to our credit card, you might be able to go up to that limit, but you don't always want to stay at that limit. So I think that is maybe the difference between what Republicans are talking about and what you're talking about, Representative Kahn. But I do.
Would you tell my wife that, please?
Yeah. Well, and just, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I find it interesting now this discussion about how we can maybe push the debt limit up higher for the state, and 4 days ago, doing any sort of debt for roads or bridges in this state was taboo because the governor had proposed that and the DFL hadn't. And so I think that's an interesting dichotomy that's changed within a week here, potentially at the Capitol. But
well, Representative Westrom, I'm not going to take you on that, but I'll talk to you afterwards about whose proposal is for who. But go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just note that. I think we bond for lots of things, and the longer you can... If you buy something that's going to have you have great years in value, it's probably as good a thing to borrow for. But I just note that for the audience here that's watching, because there was lots of talk against doing any bonding for transportation projects. Don't ring it up on the credit card, et cetera, and that's essentially what bonding does for our state, whether it's roads or state buildings. And I think the underlying is, I think 3% is what we want to stay below, not at.
Okay, let's see. I had Representative Kahn very quickly, because we do want to continue on.
Looking at this second page, I see some language on it which I hadn't seen since we had a long argument about the zoo many years ago. But do we have any moral obligation debt in the state, and what is moral obligation debt considered to be?
Mr. Gutschalter?
Anyone. It's on the page 2 of the
memo. Would Gopher Stadiums be a moral obligation debt? Would the St. Paul Port Authority buildings that were financed over and above the 3% at the time, because they were gone through the St. Paul Port Authority, would that be a moral obligation debt?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not certain of the answer, and so rather than give you half an answer, I'll get back on that.
Okay. That might be helpful. Okay, Dr. Stenson, I know you have a couple of things left and you need to go, and I want to get to a little bit on the spending side as well. So we diverted for about a half hour, I think, in important information. We'll probably be asking for additional information as you go along. Okay? Dr. Sens?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to summarize where we're at or where I was at, the construction issue is an important issue. We're particularly concerned about the skilled tradesmen being not rehired and not finding employment this spring. That's really what our concern is, that the housing downturn is largely completed, and so now we have people that would normally be starting work again on some new buildings, and there aren't things there for them to work on.
Can you just give us a little bit of idea of how we might, in the short term, stimulate that?
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that if you're thinking, and this comes back to the capital budget, obviously, if you're thinking about the structure of the capital budget, in these economic times, you might put a higher weight on repair and renovation activity and a lower weight on things like purchases of land for future projects or something like that, because really the issue is how do you get that money out there in people's pockets quickly. And as I've said before, I'm sure you've heard me say before, the test of a stimulus package as opposed to long-term investment is it timely, is it temporary, and is it well targeted. And to be timely, it needs to get out there relatively quickly. If you wait until May to pass a capital budget and the renovation and repair part of the capital budget is in that and it's not approved until May, and then takes until August or September to let the contracts, you know, that's good. I mean, it helps people, but it doesn't help people as quickly as if you were somehow able to get the repair and renovation portion agreed to and out the door in March so that those contracts would be available for people to begin working on sooner than that. So there are really two pieces. One is the speed, and two is the structure of the capital budget that you propose. And the normal, these aren't normal times. In normal times, you might have a different waiting for repair and renovation and longer-term effects.
Mr. Showalter, can I just skip 2 years on this? Dr. Stinson, you wanted to spend just a second on the last one?
Let me just real quickly summarize. There are, we think, substantial downside risks to the forecast, and the substantial downside risk in part is the weaker economy in the first part of 2009. The second one is the weaker economy affecting capital gains, and both of those leave us concerned about a larger drop in the economy than is currently in the forecast, and therefore a larger drop in revenues. And so again, this becomes a risk management strategy. How do you prepare yourself, or where do you leave the state as you look on out into the future, given that there are potential large downside drops? And again, this graph shows you the capital gains, what happened in 2001, 2002, 45% decline, 22% decline. The next year, this time, we only have a 5% decline in the forecast. So those are the concerns. The risk is real. There's upside potential. We may escape the recession. Capital gains may not be as bad as we have, but there's also real potential downside risk here. And so I would urge you just to be cautious in dealing with this problem.
Okay. Mr. Joel, do you want to touch us a little bit on the spending that's in front of us?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members. There are some small changes in the February forecast associated with the spending side of the equation. The total change in the February forecast is $64 million, of which actually $33 million is the release of targeted case management funds to the counties. That was an appropriation that was made in the last legislative session and was held in a specific reserve, but actually does not add to the deficit. But it does add to the total spending figure that you see here. In short, the K-12 forecast is pretty consistent, as you would expect, with the February forecast, although there is a correction of some of the pupil count figures that are included in that, which essentially increase the number of pupils that are counted in that program, resulting in about a $17 million.
Can I just stop you just right there? Usually we don't see that kind of an increase, because we know how many kids are in school come at the end of September. How come that's a pretty good size increase?
Mr. Chair, you are quite correct. There was a correction in the number of students in the care and treatment facilities. Essentially, some of the background spreadsheets didn't include the full number of students that were in that segment, and so as a result, the November forecast for pupil counts did not include those pupils.
Do you have a number of pupils that is affected?
Not handy, but I will check in the book. My suspicion is we have some more further information there.
Very good. Thank you.
Further down, you'll see Health and Human Services increased by $74 million. 33 again of that was from the targeted case management reserve that was released. The remainder of the increases are largely from health care costs associated with medical assistance, family and children, as well as general assistance medical care, primarily serving single adults. Those two segments of population are sensitive to economic changes, and as a result, some of our forecasts for enrollment are up in those segments. Those are somewhat balanced off by slight decreases in some of the capitation rates for elderly and disabled.
Otherwise, the all other change is really more related to dedicated spending, which is paired with dedicated revenue. So not a lot of net change there either. So the short story is not much change in this forecast on the spending side. It's in the general fund. There are some small changes in the non-general fund side within the Health Care Access Fund. Enrollment continues not to grow quite as quickly as the earlier projections. So the balance there does rise somewhat. TANF is relatively stable.
Okay. Question?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I have a question. The unit deals with the spending estimates.
Mm-hmm.
A week ago, I asked a series of questions in anticipation of the budget forecast, and the number has come in significantly higher. At the time, you said that the accounts of the legislature would be flat or negative. You've seen the number, and we know what we have to deal with, so I assume they will not be flat. Now I would like to know what will be the negative targets for our accounts, since this is the Ways and Means Committee.
Well, we're working on the figure, and I have a little bit of preliminary. If we solve it by, by cut period, which everyone wants to kind of do, the state government will shrink 54%. I don't know if you're prepared for that.
Chair,
okay, Representative Pawlowski.
Chair, I appreciate the 54% number. I would appreciate then articulate it over what would happen to K-12, higher ed, health and human services, government agencies. What would the breakdown be in our divisions? I realize we have a number of fiscal divisions and it could take some time, but what would be the negative account number to each of those divisions that they would have to deal with in the next couple of weeks?
Representative Pawlowski, I don't have that number yet, but that leads, if I can, to a question for the commissioner, if I may interrupt that, and that is, we expect the governor's recommendations when?
Mr. Chairman, I was a little optimistic yesterday, but Friday, a week from today.
A week from today?
Yeah.
So, Representative Pawlowski, I guess we're going to be looking at the governor's recommendations and see what some ideas he may have. Some ideas we've given the charge to each of the fiscal chairs to be looking for different savings or different ways of being able to do things. We've asked, in fact, there's some legislation going through that we've signed on to try to get some more creative ideas from the bureaucracy as well, to have more data in front of us. And we're going to be working on this particular problem, I think, in the next few weeks.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, but I had one other question last week. We have, moving through the House, bills that are spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, in our division, and there are lengthy hearings that have been going on these bills. Now, my assumption is there will be no increase in spending in the House. Are we going to continue to have lengthy hearings in our fiscal divisions on spending bills, or will there be a focus on trying to decide whether there will be a 1 or 2 or 3% target for those fiscal divisions?
As an independent cuss as I am and chair of a committee, I have the opportunity to establish the agenda for the committee, and I would never tell another committee chair what to hear or not hear, nor would I ever deny a member of the legislature from either side of the political aisles to be able to present a particular bill before the committee. But I think a realization has taken place, and we will be looking at all information and the realization that we have a budget difficulty. Additionally, we have been working very closely with the Department of Finance on the bills that have gone through Ways and Means. There's been three, and we have obtained those figures from the Department of Finance, and both Representative Carlson and I have had considerable conversations with Commissioner Hansen, and he's responded in a way that showed a lot of cooperation. So I think we need to continue that dialogue. I don't know if that answers your question, but obviously the chairs can can hear a particular proposal. And there are some things that are looming out on the horizon that the legislature needs to address as well.
Well, Representative Solberg, it didn't answer the question, but perhaps by raising the question, we'll get an answer over the next couple of weeks.
Sure. You bet. Representative Garofalo.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, the 54% number was put out there, and I just want to make sure that members of the committee have a fully accurate picture of the fiscal situation of the state. My recollection is that the previous biennium general fund spending was $31 billion. I'm looking at Mr. Marks, pretty busy, but I think it's $31 billion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me correct my. I said 54% of the agency budget.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The state agency.
State agency budget.
Okay. So
I didn't mean to say
that. If we're looking at the total state budget picture, the previous biennium was $34,497,000,000, Mr. Marks. I think it's in the right ballpark. And what we're looking at right now is keep things with the forecast right now, I think we're talking about spending $2 billion more than the previous biennium versus $3 billion more than the previous biennium. Because something we're not taking into account here is the $1 billion in surplus revenue from the previous biennium that was carried forward to this biennium. And the numbers are a matter of perspective, but that's what it is. We're talking about spending $2 billion more versus $3 billion more. Thank you.
Other things, other questions? Dr. Stenson, Commissioner Hansen, Mr. Commissioner Showalter, we appreciate very much your opportunity to be and your cooperation to be here.
I'm sorry?
Representative
Hilke. Representative Hilke, I'm sorry, you had a question?
I did, Mr. Chair, but Representative McNamara asked my question. If he thinks he got an answer to it, he can explain it to me. But otherwise, I thought I would take this up with Mr. Showalter after the meeting.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you very much for attending Friday, and the meeting is adjourned.